This is John McMurray. I'm sitting today with Barry Bloom, who is the national baseball writer for MLB.com. We are in Miami, Florida at Sabre 26 on July the 30th, 2016, and I'm recording it with Barry's permission. And we are here today to talk about his long career covering Major League Baseball, which...
And other sports.
And other sports. And Barry, after really 40 years of covering baseball, what is it about the game that still catches your eye? What retains its appeal?
Well, it's not the game as much as it is the people. You know, you build relationships over long periods of time. People who I've covered as players are managers, coaches. They're getting into the Hall of Fame at some point. It started with Tony Gwynn. I had covered him from the time he got into the major leagues to the end of his career. Then Roberto Alomar, who I knew when he was 17 years old. And
warm up on your coffee?
Met him down in Puerto Rico with his family. Really, when you get to Cooperstown and you realize that every one of the 54 Hall of Famers who were there, you've either seen play or covered, and you have a relationship with most of them, it's really special. I just really enjoy the process of, every day going to the ballpark, watch the game, find something interesting or different about it, report it, and then sit down and write about it.
Now, and we hear a lot today about the disconnect between the press and players. I know you have a photo of Tony Gwynn on your own Twitter page. To what degree do you become friendly with players after a point? Do they not necessarily think of you as a reporter and themselves as a player, and you kind of bridge that gap a little bit?
Yeah, I don't find there to be much disconnect today between the writers or myself and the players. I'm not going to speak for anybody else. I mean, it's obviously a different situation where, when I broke into the business 40 years ago, I was on my first baseball beat. I was in my 30s. All the players were either in their 20s or 30s, and so we were all at the same level. Then I began to notice that as those players went away, because players have a lot more short shelf life than the writers do, I started to become older to the younger players, and as a 40-year-old to 20-year-old, now I'm like 64 years old to 20-year-olds, and the older players are like 40 years old. But, I found that this is all about building relationships and trust. I don't get set back easily by players who are angry or arrogant or put up a wall. I work hard to establish relationships with guys like Matt Kemp and Ichiro, even though they might be difficult. I really don't take a no for an answer. So I find a way, to come back at them and develop a relationship with them. And really, a young man like Andrew Miller, who's 31 years old, he's one of the nicest young men I've met in baseball in years. And, while I don't have what I'd call a friendship relationship with him, I've got a great rapport with him, and he's great at answering questions. Dylan Betances is a very nice young man. Gregorius on the Yankees is a really nice young man. I mean, you can go around the league and you pick these guys out. It's not like I like Manny Machado's really nice. Arenado's nice. I mean, these all they really want from people is that they want accountability. That, and this is always the way it's been, if you write something about them that is essentially maybe critical, they want to see you in the clubhouse the next day. So if they're angry at you or they want to talk to you about it, you're there. What they hate is the guys who hit and run or are doing it from their bedrooms and are never in the clubhouse, and they have no recourse to even talk to them about it or talk it out. because, you know, sometimes you might have a point of view on something, and you could be wrong. So the player wants to have a point of view with you, or manager wants to have a point of view with you about, you know, where'd you come from when you wrote this? I had an experience a few years ago with Nick Hundley when he was with the Padres. And we were sitting on the bench the next day in the dugout at Chase Field after I wrote something about him the night before. I don't even recall what it was. And he sat there very politely, and he asked me why I wrote it. And then I explained it to him, and then I looked at him. I said, you know, I've got to tell you, that's the most cordial and the nicest way any ball player has ever said to me they didn't like something I wrote. It's not difficult. It really isn't. And it's why I was able to develop a relationship with Barry Bonds. You know, you get through the crust and the veneer, and you build a relationship where at some point they know they can talk to you about something, and it's not going to wind up in print if they don't want it. But they need sounding boards. They want a vet. I mean, I've had many more off-the-record sessions with Barry than I've had on. So I think that's just generally what it's all about.
Now, I mean, would you say that most players have been receptive to that approach that you described?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's any player that I haven't been able to reach. And you see it in terms of, I think, longtime guys like Bob Nightingale, who's a good friend of mine and a contemporary. You know, he has a little different way of going about it than I do, but it's the same thing. You know, they see you around, they know you have a national platform. You know, they know that it's probably a good idea for them to build a relationship with you and not get into any sort of, like, you know, back and forth that's going to be detrimental to them. The only thing I know now is that the difference between it today and and 10, 15 years ago is the presence of social media, where they could say something and it has an impact and you could put it out there immediately. And it can go on YouTube, so they have to be a lot more careful. A manager, too, has to be a lot more careful. The crass, you know, responses from guys like Billy Martin, Dick Williams, Gene Mock, it would never happen today, because they'd be fired in 2 minutes, you know, but as soon as it got out there. Because essentially, if you don't have a decent relationship with these guys, they know that you can use the, you know, your format as a reporter, as a whip, mm-hmm. You know, and it's the old, the pen is mightier than the sword, and they could be as angry with you or as nasty with you as they want to be, and you could be just as nasty back. You know, it's how much guts do you have to get involved in this kind of thing before they back down?
Tell me from the very beginning, what inspired your interest in baseball in particular? And I know you've covered many sports over time, so what is it that... When did your first interest in baseball take hold?
Well, my father took me to Yankee Stadium in 1960 for a game against the Cleveland Indians. And my first memory of baseball was the last out of the 1958 World Series. I remember watching Mickey Mantle catch the final out against the Milwaukee Braves. The Yankees won the World Series in center field. And just the whole green expanse of the stadium. And my father used to always laugh because I loved the electronic scoreboard. And he said I spent more time looking at the scoreboard than I did at the game on the field. But at that point, that's where my interest in baseball took hold, and then I started watching it on a regular basis. You know, I became a live-and-die Yankee fan, really still am. And I'm probably hypercritical over the Yankees more than any other team because I do have partiality to them as a fan. But as soon as I realized that I wasn't going to replace Mickey Mantle in center field for the Yankees, that's when I decided, okay, how else am I going to get into this? And I was already, even in junior high school, I was a pretty good writer. So it was just easy for me. I went to Dewitt Clinton High School in the Bronx. They had an award-winning newspaper. So I just went, when I went to high school, I just joined the newspaper. And they put me in, I think the first thing I ever covered was a fencing match. So I covered fencing, I covered track, I covered basketball. I love basketball. So basketball, hockey, football, baseball, any of them were, you know, pretty much good enough. But baseball, you know, as you know, is a sustaining factor. I mean, there's nothing like the baseball season, you know, starting from the first day of spring training and going through the last game of the World Series. I mean, it just has such an everyday effect, and it's so much part of the fabric of your life, and it's such a complicated game to understand and watch, and it really is, no matter how many thousands of baseball games you go to see, you can go out to the ballpark and see something on a given day that you've never seen before because of the infinite combination of things that could happen on the field during a game. So the seat of it was as a 10-year-old at Yankee Stadium, and it just kind of grew from there.
So your career choices as you went through college and later got a master's degree were all designed to get you to become a baseball reporter? Were you have a sort of a linear path, or was it still open in your mind?
Well, like anything in life, you know, you never know what's going to take you in one direction or another. You know, I had kind of a stranger path because when I graduated from, I grew up in New York, as I said, went to college at Fairleigh Dickinson University, got an English Lit degree. When I graduated from college in the early 70s, 73, 74, I wanted to travel around the country and see the country before I really started going to work. I realized it's probably the only time in my life I was going to have a chance to do that. So a friend and I got in a car. We were also big hockey fans. I had a Rangers season ticket at Madison Square Garden. So it was really, if I get a hockey game and a baseball game in any given day, I'm a happy guy. And it's funny how much you run into hockey executives, hockey players. You know, two of them, Ken Holland, who's the one-time general manager of the Red Wings, and Shane Doan, who plays for the Coyotes, they love baseball. So, I mean, I see them, and when I'm covering the game, when I'm covering hockey, invariably they want to talk baseball. They don't want to even talk hockey. It's amazing the crossover in the two sports. I mean, Wayne Gretzky played baseball. Tom Glavin played hockey. It really is funny. But there's some sort of symbiosis between the two sports that people just love. So, and I called as sports director of the radio station in college. I traveled around the country with the basketball team doing basketball play-by-play, which I also love to do. And the team played like two or three games at the Garden every year. So I called, you know, maybe half a dozen games in Madison Square Garden. You know, so, and that to me was like the epitome of it. Marv Albert called basketball games at the Garden. You know, the Knicks were in their heyday in that era in the 1970s. Just in the years I was in college, we went to the Garden to see all the Knicks games during that era. You know, we had the Rangers were in their heyday of that era, and we went Stanley Cup playoff games every year, you know, including the finals in 73 that they lost. You know, the Mets won the World Series. My first World Series game was the fourth game of the 1969 World Series at Shea Stadium. And and we snuck our way into the game. That's a great story in itself. But we snuck in. My brother and I snuck into the game. And that was the game that Ron Swoboda made this flat-out incredible catch out in right field. J.C. Martin won with a bunt at the end. And, you know, I've seen 35 World Series or something and covered 35 World Series since then. So, and, you know, I've covered 11 Super Bowls, 11 Stanley Cup Finals, upteen NBA finals. I feel like I've had a very rich and varied, existence in sports. But since I went to work for MLB.com in 2002, it's been pretty strictly baseball. I haven't done much outside. I do NBA All-Star games periodically. I did a lot of hockey for our Sports on Earth this winter. Wrote a lot of hockey columns. That was fun. But now it's primarily baseball.
Now, independent of, let's say, player interviews.
Let's finish this up. When you said the linear path, it was hardly a linear path. So what happened was, my first wife and I, she was an art student, and after traveling around the country, I wanted to go to San Diego. I had relatives there. It was beautiful there. We were in Philadelphia. She was in art school there. She wanted to transfer to the San Francisco Art Institute, so we moved to San Francisco. And I went to San Francisco State to get a master's degree in broadcast communications because I had no experience in video or television. And I'm not sure where it is now, but at the time it was like top four communications departments in the country. So I was lucky to get in and go. And at that point I was freelancing and was working for a weekly newspaper. I started selling advertising, editing copy, writing. They gave me a sports column to write. I did feature stories, the whole panoply of stuff that you do for, a small newspaper. And I started my own wire service covering games for newspapers and magazines around the country that I called the Free Line. And I said, my wife and I sat down, and we wrote a letter saying that the Free Line was available to cover sports out on the West Coast, and we sent it out to every newspaper in the country. We got like 3 or 4 bites, and that's how my writing career for regular papers really started. And I've written for more papers that went out of business than probably anybody in history because, I freelance for... I think my first assignment was covering the Canadians on the West Coast for the Montreal Gazette, which was an English-speaking paper in Montreal at the time. It's long gone. They put me on an expo road trip that summer, 1976, out on the West Coast. So I went from San Francisco to L.A. to San Diego to cover the expos for them out on the West Coast. And, because of the broadcasting part of it, my career could have gone either way. Could have gone into print, could have gone into radio, could have gone into basketball, could have gone into baseball, could have gone into any of the sports because I covered every sport the first 5 years of career. And for the first 10 years working at the newspaper in San Diego, although I was hired to cover the Clippers, they put me on the Padres pretty much right away, and I did the Padres for 10 years. Every winter I did go up to L.A. and I did a lot of basketball. I did a lot of the Lakers during the Magic Johnson era. I got really friendly with Magic. Kareem was one of is probably the toughest player I've ever dealt with in any sport. And at the end of his career, I told him off. And I could have gone, if I had it broken one way, and this is where, it's sort of like the Robert Frost poem, The Path's Untaken. You come to crossroads in your life numerous periods of time, and then you stand at that road, and this is what Frost was talking about. You stand at that road, and at that crossroad, and you have one branch one way, one branch the other way, and once you go down one of those branches, there's no going back, and you never know when you're standing at the crossroads whether you're making right decision to go one way or another, and sometimes it's not under your control anyway. So when I got to San Francisco, I applied for a job at KCBS as like the weekend sports writing copy for. I wasn't even going to be on the air. It was just writing copy for the on-air people, and it came down to me and another kid who was the nephew of somebody who already worked for the station and was at UCLA, and they gave him the job. Now, if I had gotten that job at KCBS, I probably would have gone into a radio career. Instead, I got the job at the Millbrae Sun Leader doing all the things I already itemized, and I wound up in the newspaper business. And then, you know, as all the roads branch, you know, you get to like 2002, and I'm working for Bloomberg doing sports business and doing some baseball, a lot of hockey, football, whatever. You know, I get to the point where MLB.com is in its infancy, and they asked me to cover sports, you know, for them, because they wanted somebody to cover the 2002 labor negotiations at, you know, it was the last contentious labor negotiations in baseball. And through my contacts with Bud Selig and Bob Dupay in baseball, working for Bloomberg, Dupay basically said to me, come work for us, because I don't even have anybody with this labor thing that I can even talk to over there. It'd be great to have you. So I worked out, negotiated it, went over to work for MLB, had the labor gone badly, and they had gone out on strike in 2002, which Don Fair really wanted them to, but the players didn't want to go. They didn't have the stomach to go out a year after 9/11, so they basically overrode Fair. If that had not happened and they had gone out on strike, I really do think the .com would have gone down the toilet, and it would have been years before they started it up again, and I probably would have been out of a job. But, you know, at that point, it's like, do you stay at Bloomberg? Because although, you know, we had a house in San Diego, my wife wanted to go back there. Bloomberg wanted me to stay in New York. I had a job, a very good job there. You know, what do you do? So I basically said, well, my wife wants to go back to San Diego. MLB said, you can work wherever you want. We're going back to San Diego, and I took the job at MLB. So there's never a linear path on any of these things. You know, you design it, you know, in your mind in a certain way, and then you see where paths take you and how it winds up. But as you can see, when I got to MLB.com, all the, you know, the years of writing, the years of going to law school, the years of, you know, doing sports business and baseball on the field, I mean, I'm probably one of the few reporters in the country, if not the only reporter, who has, like, a very strong expertise in both sports business and sports on the field. Mm-hmm. Most guys, like, I have a great friend, Eric Fisher, who works for Sports Business Daily, and he's a tremendous sports business writer. He's never covered sports on the field or on the court. You know, Richard Sandomir at the New York Times is a good friend. Same thing. Good, great background. He's a tremendous sports business reporter, but no real expertise in covering the games on the field. So at that point in my life and my career, all these different paths come kind of circle around, and then you get there and you go, okay, well, it worked out, and that's where I've spent the last almost 15 years of my career. It's probably where I'm going to finish my career. So that's the way it works out.
You mentioned all of the games you've seen, presumably thousands, tens of thousands.
I don't know about, yeah, probably. I don't know. I have no way of counting it up.
When you watch a game in person, as opposed to watching it on television, what do you get being at the stadium that you don't get if you're at home watching a game on television, other than, let's say, player interviews? What does the scene give you rather than just what happens on the field?
Well, for writing, I mean, being there's no replacement for being there, because, you know, invariably, I'm kind of a magnet. I mean, things happen when I'm there. You know, whether it's a strange event in a game or a news event or, you know, a landmark or a milestone, like, you know, Ichiro we're looking at, who's so close now. I've had that happen over and over in my career. When I'm there, things happen to write about. So if you're not there, you know, you can't write it off of the TV. You know, you're not there with the access to the principals who you need to talk to. And then secondly, and I did a master's thesis on this, the television is it's the worst medium in the world for baseball. Because what it does is it takes a game which is not linear and it turns it into a linear game. The only way they can broadcast it, and it's better now on wider screen HDTV because it gives you a longer picture of what's going on, but they still shoot it like they shot it in a small box. They don't split up the screens enough. And when somebody figures it out that if you do simultaneous shots rather than linear sequential shots, you're going to be covering the game a lot better. Baseball, when you go to a game, there's like 100 things going on at the field at once. And you can center, especially in a press box, which is high up, you get a pretty good panorama of the field. You can see the shifting offenses and defenses. You can see, you know, if an outfield moves in, on a particular pitch. I mean, now with the extreme shifting, I mean, I just started noticing it this year. I'd never seen it before. And I asked, I first noticed it with the Red Sox, then I noticed it with the Yankees, and I talked to Girardi and Farrell about it. They are now getting so defined on the shifting that on a two-strike count, if they moved their shortstop over to second base and put their third baseman in the hole and left, they flop those guys on 0-2 pitches and move the shortstop to the left side and the third baseman to the right side. Really? And so I asked, well, why? Because their stats now tell them that the propensity for a left-handed hitter to hit the ball to the left side of the infield is greater on an 0-2 pitch because they shorten up the bat than it is earlier in the count, and they want their best fielder on that side. So if I'm not at the game, and I'm not watching this, and I'm going, what the hell? Really? They just put Gregorius. Why'd you put Gregorius over on the other side of the field and move, like Edley back to the other side? You don't pick that up on television. It's impossible.
You wouldn't even know what was going on television.
Right, you wouldn't even know what was going on television. That's why football is so great on television. Football is a linear game. It's made for television.
Some way better on television than it may be in person.
Well, the best way I've found to watch a football game is to sit in the press box, watch what's going on in the field, and have the monitor above you so you can take another look at it. And the best way to watch a baseball game is that, which is pretty much what they do in press boxes all over the place now, is they give you a little bit of like a delayed broadcast, which is like 2 or 3 seconds behind what's going on in the field. So if you have your head down because you can't pay attention to everything that's going on in a game, invariably in my job, I'm writing during the game because I have to have copy in at a certain period of time. And, if I'm covering the game, there's always one thing after another that has to be done. So it's impossible to watch the game, and pay that much attention to it. But, so you can look up at the screen if you've missed something, and you can see what you missed. That's the best way now to watch a baseball game. So, but in itself, yeah, you have to be at the game because too much is going on. It's a circular motion on the field. The bases are circular. The outfield is circular. The whole way it was designed was not meant to be linear and to watch linear. It was meant to watch, in its whole aspect.
Can you describe how your approach to writing a game story has changed over time? When you started, let's say, covering the Padres in late 1982, you were writing a story for people who presumably had not seen the game, certainly didn't have access to the video of the game, and were perhaps creating a scene in a way that you don't have to today. Is the game, and in that question is also whether a game story is really as important now when people can access every aspect play-by-play of the game instantly and may not sit down and read a story about how a game proceeded.
It's a good question because my first job in San Diego was for a PM paper, so we really didn't write game stories per se because the game was over for many hours before that paper would hit the doorstep. So you have to write what we then called the PM story, which is perfect for the internet. Because I learned early that you have to go against the grain, go into the locker room, get information, and tell people something that they don't know about. Because, as in this case, if you're a Padre fan, you would probably, if you hadn't seen the game or listened to the game, you probably would have picked up the morning paper and gotten the play-by-play in the morning paper. So when the PM paper, our paper, came out hours later, you couldn't justifiably redo what they did in the morning. So, in fact, one of the reasons why I was put on the Padres after I was hired by the Clippers, I already had a very strong news background and a good inclination for news. And the editor of the paper at the time, Tom Cushman, had just come from Philadelphia, where the papers warred with each other, and they created all kind of controversy about the sports teams. You know, the New York and Philly approach to covering the games. And they wanted to do this in San Diego, so they put me on it because the person who was on the beat long time before me didn't have the stomach to do it, didn't want to do it. And so they put me on the beach and they told me to do it and essentially said, stir it up. You know, if you don't want to do it, we'll get somebody else who will. And I go, they didn't say that, but it was implicit. And I said, sure, no problem. Dick Williams was the manager. He was a bully. He liked to bully people. He never had any friends. He's one of the few guys I've ever met in the game. Every guy has, no matter how irascible they were, Billy Martin was like this. Mock was like this. They always had a writer in their back pocket who they were friendly with, who they could go to. Bobby Valentine was a master at that. And he was one of the guys I got along. I love Bobby Valentine because he was intelligent and he would tell me things that he wouldn't tell anybody else. So it's like, okay, what's there not to like? You know, but so at that point, I was never writing game stories. And then, you know, the one year I covered the Padres, two of us covered the Padres after the papers were merged. And I had to write morning game stories. I still wrote them like in kind of a PM fashion, you know, with very little play-by-play in them. And so, you know, what's happened now and the way it's all evolved anyway is that it's the same approach. I mean, you want to tell people something that they didn't see because they weren't at the game and they didn't know, or a play happened, they want to know what happened in that play, what happened behind the scenes. And you want to break down the incident, you want to get principles quoted about on it, you want, if there's a rule involved, you want to explain the rule. You know, we have a formatted game story at our place now, which met some resistance from the older writers. I think it's a great idea. You know, you just put a top on it. There are like moments that mattered in the game. There's like specific interesting quotes. If you throw like a stat or something, you know, that it's sort of like smarter than the average bear kind of thing. And then, you know, what's the next game? That's the game story. It's a quick format, quick read. And then you write sidebars on, or columns on, you know, what happened, you know, behind the scenes. So it's really not that much different. You know, it's different from the AM approach, the New York Times AP approach to writing a game story, which really doesn't exist much anymore either. But it's not much different than covering for a PM paper 30 years ago.
You mentioned about telling the reader something that the reader doesn't know, but there's also this demand to get content out quickly. Does this come at the expense of quality writing? We're long past, let's say, having very lyrical sports writing as we may have had in the 1920s or something like that.
Right.
But as you mentioned, the potentially somewhat formulaic way of potentially writing a game story, have we gotten to the point where the writing is being lost at the expense of churning out content?
Well, personally, I hope not. I mean, you know, I continue. I mean, you learn your reporting skills, and those never leave you. You know, one of the things I found that when I was moved from the sports department to the news department and I went kicking and screaming was that in short order, in a couple of years, I learned a lot of techniques of covering news that I never knew before, and it made me a much better overall reporter. And I always say that, you know, when I was in high school, I had a great English journalism teacher. Her name was Ada Charles. And I learned everything I needed to know about journalism from her. That was my foundation. By the time I got to college, I didn't need a communications or journalism program. I already pretty much knew. And then I did an English Lit degree to read a whole, you know, wide range of writers, English and American, to just find different styles. And, you know, it turned out that I had a professor who loved F. Scott Fitzgerald, and he turned us on to all of F. Scott Fitzgerald stuff. And The Great Gatsby turned out to be my favorite novel. And I read it once a year, every year, you know, just or every 2 years. You know, I go, yeah, I need to read The Great Gatsby again. And then I sit down and run through it because it's just so beautifully written. So, you know, my feeling is that the reporting skills are there. There's not much more I'm going to learn about that. But I can be a better writer every day. You know, and I always like to give people, you know, the color of things. You know, what color was this, you know, if there was a curtain behind it, what color was it? You know, I just described the Hall of Fame the other day, that the whole scene on the porch at the Otisaga Hotel that the Hall of Famers are taking out, they're taken out on the porch after their induction. Johnny Bench sits them down, tells them to look out on the lake. What's the color of the lake? The porch is white. The chairs are white. The rocking chairs are out there. They're white. You know, it's those things. You know, it's like I had an editor, one of my first editors at the Tribune, he called it texture. He used to say, give me a little bit of this, rubbing his thumb against his fingers. Give me a little bit of texture. And so, you know, you look at things. I try to notice things. What's the sign that's hanging up on the wall? What color is that sign? You know, what's that person saying? There are little details that are not hard to put into a story, and they're not. It doesn't take a while to write them. That gives your story or column a little bit more, you know, texture or meaning to somebody than somebody else, and puts that person there. So, no, you know, I don't. It's one thing is churning out information, which you're doing in a game story, but the other thing is, you know, writing about something, and I hope that I never learn enough. That, you know, I learn something new every day. I'm never going to be as good a writer today as I am tomorrow. I'm always trying to stretch as a writer. .com certainly gives me the ability to do it. You know, but we don't have, it's not like a newspaper where you have to fill a certain hole. I mean, we have infinite space. I mean, generally, my columns run 900 to 1,000 words. I try to keep them there. Sometimes I go a little longer. I'll go maybe to like somewhere between 1,000 and 1,100. Every once in a while, they'll cut something out to bring it back down to size. 99% of the time they don't. They leave it, which I think that, well, is the editor who reads it, you know, the producer who produces it, and I think it's a modicum of respect for me as a, you know, as an experienced writer, that if I have it in there, there's a reason why it's there. So Marshall McLuhan said the medium is the message. And the medium has changed. And his time, he defined how the coming of television and video changed film, radio, and the printed word. And now you have so many different ways of transferring all these things, but it's still the same thing. It's still video, whether it's posted instantaneously, and it's still printed word, whether it gets put on actual print or actually gets put on a screen, and you read it on your PDA or your iPad, or you're reading it in a magazine, and then they different format it. I mean, I wrote like half the All-Star Game program. You know, I wrote a piece on Trevor Hoffman, a piece on Tony Gwynn, a piece on the '98 Padres. And they posted all that stuff online for everybody to read online. And then it was there if you bought the magazine at the ballpark or you buy it now. So, I mean, you double format these things. It gives you a wider audience. And, you know, you can't really get into a situation where you think you're not being, you think you're under pressure to produce things so you can't write anymore. It's crazy. You can't.
Take me back to when you first started covering the Padres. You started in 82. I mean, that was a team that was 500, had Dick Williams as his manager, but also a fair number of, I mean, Tony Gwynn had his start that year, but he didn't have an outstanding 82 season in limited time. You know, you think of people, Terry Kennedy, Rupert Jones, Juan Eichelberger, Gary Lucas, people like that. But it wasn't a particularly distinguished team, although it would go on to the World Series a couple of years later. What were your impressions when you first got to the major leagues covering this particular team that at that time hadn't had a lot of franchise success? And how they treated you, what you were able to learn in your first year reporting?
Well, first of all, you know, because I started out on the West Coast, I'd been covering a lot of the Padres from like 1976 to 82 before I even got there. So, you know, they'd gone through Roger Craig as the manager, John McNamara, Frank Howard, Jerry Coleman even had a year down on the field, you know, while I was living in San Francisco. So I used to see the Padres like two or three times a year in San Francisco, and maybe a couple of times in San Diego, you know, every year. So I pretty much got to know the organization and the people in the front office and the general managers and McKeon.
Yeah.
So by the time I got to San Diego, I was pretty well, you know, grounded on the Padres. Two funny stories. I got hired in San Diego on Labor Day of 1982. So I was still freelancing, and I was down in San Diego. One of the papers in Philly I worked for was a paper called the Camden Courier Post, and they used to put me on the Phillies for the whole West Coast trip when the Phillies came out there, because this was the time when, as I explained with the Gazette, it was starting to get too onerous for some papers to send their writers and pay the foot bill all the way across the country, you know, for them to be on the road. So their beat writers weren't traveling out to the West Coast anymore. And that built some resentment among the existing writers at the time and me, because they felt like I was stealing West Coast trips away from them, where in reality, I had nothing to do with it. I was just filling a void. And if I wasn't there, they probably wouldn't have covered the trips. They would have just used the wire service. So I gave them an alternative at like $75 a story or $100 a story. And if I covered an eight-game trip, it cost them $800 as opposed to like the thousands and thousands of dollars it would have cost to somebody out there. And then I just drew my expenses. I stayed with my family. It was cheap to fly back and forth around California at that time, so I just drew my expenses out of what I was being paid. That was part of the business. So I was down in San Diego for the Camden Courier Post. The Phillies were coming in, and the Padres were playing a series. I don't even remember who was against. But Rupert Jones had a doubleheader, and I think he struck out eight times in a doubleheader on a Saturday night. On Sunday, he showed up late to the clubhouse drunk. Now, Williams was in the process of like taking this team and turning it into, you know, a decent team. And there was a transition there from the laissez-faire Frank Robinson, Frank Howard, Jerry Coleman days to, you know, Dick's harsh approach to players. I mean, his approach was just, he knocked heads with the players. He didn't want to hear from them about it. It's like, I'm the manager. I don't care how much money you make. I don't care if you make more money than me. I'm going to make the calls on these things, and too bad. So Jones shows up to the locker room late and drunk, and he gets taken out of the lineup. And the next day, they jettisoned Rupert Jones. So it comes up from the minor leagues, Tony Gwynn. It's like June or July. I think it was June. Because it was a year. And all the weird things of Tony's career, there are so many coincidences. I think he came up on June 16th or July 16th. you know, to 1982, and it was like, might have been just like right the exact date he was drafted, so it would have been June 16th of 81 he was drafted, 81. He came up like a year after he was drafted. And I was there. They played the Phillies. I was covering it for the Camden Courier Post. So I happened to be there the day Tony Quinn got his first hit. It was a double. And then 29 years later, his son got his first hit, and it was a double. These are the strange, you know, things in the Quinn family careers. But by the time I got there, I was hired to cover the Clippers. I wasn't hired to cover the Padres. And, you know, so I started in September of 82, and training camp was opening for the Clippers. Don Sterling owned the Clippers, and I had my own war going with Don Sterling, you know, almost from the get-go, and so had the paper. And he was in the process. He had already tried to move the team under the cover of darkness to L.A. The league had kept him from doing it. And then I was thrown in the middle of this mess with a team that, you know, had no training camp, no training no preseason schedule, no real roster. They had to build a roster as training camp went on. They were adding players and losing players. And then, you know, in the middle of that, I got put in an afternoon on Sunday afternoon or a night game. You know, I covered my first Padre game for the Tribune just to fill in while the other guy took a day off on a Sunday. So by midway through 83, when I was off from the summer for basketball, my editor put me on a Padre road trip because he was sick and tired of the way the other guy was covering it. He tried somebody else the year before, and that guy who was a good friend of mine, he couldn't handle the PM cycle. He'd be on the road. He'd go out instead of writing a story and then going out. He'd go out and then come back to the room, you know, crocked, trying to write a story. And, you know, the desk would call him at like 6 o'clock in the morning, where's your story? Oh, and then he'd have to get up and write the story. So enough of that. That didn't work. He goes, do you want to do some baseball? Sure. So they send me out, and he goes, okay, don't take any crap from Dick Williams. Don't worry about it. So that started the war with me. You know, I didn't realize it at the time, but, you know, McKeon and Williams were already at, you know, log jam between the two of them. There was warring factions in the front office. The club president, Ballard Smith, you know, basically wanted Williams. Jack McKeon didn't want him. And so you had this five-year fight here, you know, brewing, that just got worse and worse between Williams and McKeon. And then I just got thrust in the middle of it and had to cover it. So when my editor said, you know, Williams rips the players. When he does, go to the player and tell him what he said and get a quote from the player. Well, sure. So Williams said something. I go to the player. He said that. Well, blah, 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 blah. So the next day, Williams would pick up the paper, and then he'd go to the player. What the fuck? You said this? And the player would go, oh, I didn't say that. I don't, you know. So it was at that point I, you know, took notes, and then I started to realize better use a tape recorder because when they say that they didn't say it, I want to have it on tape so that when Williams goes to my editor or says something to me about it, or McKeon says something to me about it, I want to have it documented so that you know, they know that I'm not making it up. Because what the player, and then so I became the villain in the whole thing, because if it wasn't for the players in the locker room were sort of like, well, Williams does this, we're doing this, but if Barry Bloom weren't in the middle of this stirring it up, we wouldn't have this problem. And this was really the, you know, the whole climate I worked under at the Tribune, covering the Padres from the time I took it over full-time in 84 till the time, you know, basically McKeon finally got fired in 1989. And then the newspaper itself basically, you know, they got involved because our publisher, a guy named Herb Klein, who was a Nixon press secretary, you know, he was involved in all the minutiae of getting Super Bowls and venues and stuff on the Sports Council in San Diego. The Padres were sold, Joan Crock sold the team to Tom Werner and a group of San Diego, you know, locals who all were in, you know, cahoots with Klein. And they complained to Klein about the way I covered the team, and they pulled me off the team and put me on this side, but and created a greater monster doing that. But you never know what the consequences are of doing something until you do it. So, long answer too.
You have an obvious affection for Tony Gwynn. What did he have that other players didn't have, besides the obvious?
Well, there are a couple of players. Steve Garvey was like, I still have immense amount of respect and affection for Steve Garvey. And Garvey, went in 1984, the Padres had this big bean burl war in Atlanta, and it was like the worst thing I've ever seen to this day on a baseball field. And I wrote that William should be, suspended. If the league doesn't suspend him, the Padres should suspend him, and the Padres should basically be ashamed of themselves for the way they handled it. So all the players on the team turned against me, and that was brewing anyway. And they had a 24-1 vote to kick me out of the clubhouse. And Garvey was the only one who voted for me. And basically he said, well, I may not like the way he writes every once in a while, but, you know, he has a First Amendment right to his opinion, and so I'm not voting against him. And Garvey, I knew him from the Dodgers. When I was a kid reporter coming up in the 70s, doing the freelancing stuff I explained to you about, you know, Garvey and Lasorda were two people who took me under their wings right away. And there was no reason for it. I was a nobody. You know, I was writing for papers all over the country. They had no idea who I was. I'd just show up at Dodger Stadium for an errand series here. I'd see him in San Francisco. And they were always cordial and lovely, and, you know, and I told Lasorda this. I had breakfast with him in Cooperstown the other day, and he was with some friends, and I explained it to him, to explain the same thing to them. You know, and then Dave Winfield in San Diego was the same way. You know, he treated me with an incredible amount of respect. And, you know, those are the guys that when you have a profile, it's one thing. When you have no profile and they're just treating you that way because those are the type of people they are, that's how you learn who your people are. And when Gwynn came in, like I said, I saw his first hit. You know, 82, he played, he broke a wrist or something in 83. Then he broke a wrist in 82, broke his other wrist in winter ball that winter, and missed the first part of the 83 season. Really didn't get started until mid-83 when they all decided, I think the outfield was Lascano, Rupert Jones was, I think, gone already, Gene Richards, and in the middle of the season they just decided, you know, enough is enough, we don't want this outfield anymore. They got rid of all those guys. They brought up Gwynn from the minor leagues for good, Kevin McReynolds from the minor leagues, had Alan Wiggins in left field, who was problematic in himself with his drug problems, and Gwynn was such a nice kid. He was like one of the nicest kids I ever met. And in the end, he said that Garvey was signed as a free agent on that team in 1983. And that's really what changed the whole franchise. To me, and when people say, why is Garvey's number retired in San Diego? Because the 5 years he played there irrevocably changed the franchise from being a nothing franchise to being a recognizable franchise that people took seriously. It's kind of like when Junior was drafted by the Mariners, and then they went out and picked up Randy Johnson. In a young, you know, era of a franchise that was doing nothing from losing, those are the things that start to bring it over the top. Right. And Gwynn was part of that legitimacy of the franchise. He was the best player they ever drafted. He's the only Padre who played 20 years there and, you know, played for the, you know, and went in the Hall of Fame. You know, Trevor will probably ultimately get in. He played 16 years there, but started his career somewhere else and finished his career somewhere else. That probably is never going to be another Padre like Quint. Maybe. Who knows? But not for the foreseeable, because there's nobody there right now. So it was just the type of... He learned from Garvey that, good or bad, you had to be accessible to the media every day and accountable to the media every day, even if you didn't do anything in a game. So Garvey sat there at his locker every day in Los Angeles and San Diego, and if you needed him for something, whether he did anything in the game or not, he was always there. And then he always treated you with a tremendous amount of respect. And Gwynn watched this, and Garvey told Gwynn, somebody has to be there every day, good or bad. And when Garvey retired, Gwynn became that person, whether he wanted to do it or really or not. And he just became everybody's go-to guy. And in the end, Garvey, when Gwynn died, Garvey told me he became... It started with him being a mentor to Gwynn, ended with Gwynn being a mentor to Garvey. Because Gwynn had his childhood sweetheart he went to high school with. They got married. He had their two kids. The son was always around. Little Tony was always around the clubhouse from the time he was little. And Garvey had a fractured marriage. You know, all these women that he met, kids that he wound up bringing up. And he said, I really wanted what Gwynn had. I wanted a stable marriage and kids of my own that I could have come into the clubhouse. You know, and he said, Gwynn taught me what my life was should have been like. And from the point of all his problems, Garvey essentially, you know, has been pretty straight and narrow with his family, his secondary family, and his second wife, who's lovely, and I've become really good friends with. So, essentially, you know, Gwynn is really an extension to me of Garvey, and you know, with the caveat that, you know, Garvey took much better care of himself, just like Itro. You compare him on the field very much, same profile as Tony, the way he approaches the game. You know, both of them had power. They didn't utilize it. They just wanted to play, get hits. Tony, from the day he got in the major leagues, his goal was 3,000 hits. He didn't care what he had to do to get there. And he felt at a certain point, especially when he was young, that if he pulled the ball too much and gave up power, you know, his base hits for power, he would never get to 3,000 hits. Now, be that as it may, later in his career, after Ted Williams shamed him into it, he started turning on the ball, and he hit 17 homers and knocked in 118 runs. And it became a point of contention among the players in the clubhouse, much like Ichiro, that, hey, in batting practice, if you're getting the ball out, and Gwynn, you're batting third, but you're not driving in any runs, you're just, you know, hitting the ball, slapping the ball into left field for a base hit because you just want the base hits. It became a point of contention among players in a certain era in the Padre clubhouse who detested Gwynn for just much like the Dodgers detested Garvey. They detested Garvey because of the media exposure that he gave us. They detested Gwynn for the same thing. They thought Garvey was a complete phony. He really wasn't. Gwynn, you know, if you met Garvey's father, Joe, that was Garvey. He was just, you know, the old cliche, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. Joe was the greatest guy in the world. You know, I didn't know Tony's father that well. I'd met him a few times, but he was much like Tony. And, you know, and players, you know, when Barry was going after the home run title, Omar Vizquel was sitting there in the locker room, pissed off that everybody went to talk to Barry every day and nobody was talking to him. And I actually explained to Vizquel that, you know what, watching you play every day, you're playing in the American League, I didn't see you play that much. Now I'm watching you play every day for the Giants. When it comes down to a Hall of Fame vote and you're on the ballot, I may now vote for you for the Hall of Fame because now I've seen you play. There's an auxiliary thing to this, having a lot of national people around covering this, that's going to have an effect on you that you may not see right now. So don't complain so much about it. But players invariably get jealous They were jealous of Tony. They were jealous of Garvey. They had different reasons for doing it. And a lot of it is they misconceived that these guys just wanted the publicity, so they sat at their locker. And those guys actually said, we don't care about the publicity. We just know we need to be there because we need to help the writers. They have a job to do every day. You know? So I'd be the first to say that, you know, Tony had a dark side to him. I never saw in Garvey. You know, we looked past it in a lot of ways. Had a lot of financial trouble, you know, as a player. And twice had to go into bankruptcy. You know, God knows what his wife's, you know, how much money in debt they are, you know, after he died. I don't think it's good. You know, but because Tony was such a great guy, we created an image of him that really, in a lot of ways, didn't tell the whole Gwynn story. Mm-hmm. Because he was so good to us. And he was such a good friend to me. So, I mean...
Is it primarily bankruptcy that you're referring to?
A lot of things. I mean, he was a... people he was friendly with, you know, he could... What the easy way to say it is that, you know, he could get angry at you. We had our run-ins, you know, that used to come out of nowhere for no explicable reason. And I never had a run-in with Garvey. I've never had a run-in with Barry. But I had run-ins with Tony that were just ridiculous.
You would just get upset about something out of proportion?
Or? Right, exactly. And... And the other thing about Tony was he always undersold himself to the Padres because he wanted the luxury of having a long-term contract. So the Padres would always, especially McKeon, they'd always sign him cheap for 3 or 4 years and at kind of a market level or maybe just below. And as soon as he'd signed the contract, there was a free agent signing that would outmode that contract, like, right away. Mm-hmm. And instead of being like, well, I signed the contract, I'm being protected, the money's good enough for me, he'd get pissed off that he saw that the Padres took advantage of him and signed the contract. You know, and whether that came from his wife chirping in his ear, you know, I don't know. You know, but it was never... And he always wanted to stay in San Diego. He never went out there and got a contract. Never went to free agency. By the time he became a free agent. He was too old. He got offers from like the Royals and Cleveland to go play for them in his last year. He knew though how bad his knee was, and he just didn't want to go. So he played his last year in San Diego, far under market value. And he really turned John Moores, the owner of the team, over and shook out his pockets and made him pay for, like, every other owner that was there through his whole career. So...
What you describe as a dark side doesn't sound like more... The worst sounds like occasional blow-ups in the locker room.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. What I mean... Right. Well, it's no blow-ups in the locker room. They were always, personally.
Okay. Okay, and you did know him, obviously. You said you knew his dad a little bit.
Well, I knew Tony better than anybody. Yeah. The only person who knew Tony better than me was his family and his agent, John Box. And John went through the same thing with him. He was mercurial.
But when you get close to a particular player or get to know them very well, and, you know, we live in an era now, and I don't want to take all your time, but it's... when you get to know a player extremely well, and, you know, with all of the opinion reporting that we have out there, and many reporters, you know, don't even claim to be particularly objective these days, to what degree does that cloud one's objectivity, or are you just open about how you're close to particular players in the way that you write, and it's really not an issue?
You know, I try to, like, be as objective as I possibly can in painting, the picture of a player, whether I'm close to them or not. And sometimes I develop relationships with players, and I'm tougher on the players that I build the relationships with. And I've had it, you know, where people said, "Why'd you write that about me? I thought we were friends." Well, you know, first of all, it's something that, you know, my opinion about something that happened on the field. I'm not writing about your personal life here, you know, and my friendship with you doesn't have anything to do with that. I still have to cover you. And even, you know, Barry, I don't know that I'm closer to any other player but Barry. And even he once said to me, "Look, I know I'm," when he was playing, he said, "I know how tough I am to cover, and I know that, you know, that there's things you're going to write about me that I'm not going to like," and you do. And he goes, "But I understand also that you have your job to do, and you're not going to go out of your way to hurt me." And I think where I draw the line is, if Tony or Barry or something has a bad day, a lot of this is displaced anger with people. You know, they're upset at something else and they take it out on you because you're an easier source. And if Barry walked by me without saying hello one day or something happened, I wasn't going to... People rip Barry for stuff like that. You know, Barry didn't get ripped as much for what he did on the field as he did for the perception of how he was treated by people. And I can tell you there are a number of times I saw Barry try to let people in, and they would come back and they would screw him in print or on, you know, on TV anyway. And it was like, okay, I tried. I'm not going back down this well again. That's it. So, you know, if Kemp or somebody, you know, mouths off to me or ignores me or, you know, something happens on a given day, I just sort of blow it off and I'm never going to write about it. One day, I don't know that I've ever been treated with less respect by a player than Ichiro. It's just the way he treats the media, period. Mm-hmm. And he really despises the Japanese media. So, I mean, he's been here all week, and, you know, they've had scores of Japanese media here, and he doesn't. I don't know that he stopped and had an interview with them all week.
And so what does he do? Does he just walk by?
He just walks right by, or he gets out of the locker room quickly. He just doesn't make himself accessible, and people know it, so they don't even approach him.
Now, can players just be standoffish without necessarily, I mean, does it be part of their personality? Does he have an obligation in your mind to talk to the media?
He doesn't have an obligation, but as I explained to Barry when he was going after, you know, Aaron's record, the better you are with the media now, they're going to remember what you did at the end. They're not going to remember what you did 5 years ago. So, Clemens understood this because there was nobody more irascible than Clemens. But when he was going after his 300th win, when he was with the Yankees, he made a point of saying to all of us, "I want you to enjoy this as much as I'm enjoying it, and I want you to be part of the ride." And he became accessible. He became charming. You know, he was a completely different person. So he understood it. Barry really, you know, basically, he says he used the anger to play, so you have to be angry all the time. And I just think with Ichiro, he expects respect, but he doesn't want to give it back. And he just doesn't look at the media as something that's a viable, you know, thing for him. Like, from perfect example, he speaks perfect English, but he refuses to do an interview in English. He has to have his interpreter there, Alan Turner, and you ask a question, and Ichiro won't even wait for the translation. He'll just answer the question in Japanese and make him interpret it. You know, and to me, that's just disdain. You know, and I want to be treated with a certain amount of respect, just like you do. I've been around for your whole career. I've treated you with respect. I've never taken this out on you. I'll give you an example. One day, you know, he's never turned me down for an interview, and sometimes he's good, sometimes he's short. One day at Yankee Stadium, I was interviewing him with Alan standing there, and he was clipping his fingernails the whole time during the interview. And I'm listening back to the tape going, I can hear the clipping of the tape, of the fingernails on the tape as I'm, you know, listening to the interview. And it pissed me off. But at the time, I thought, do I write about him clipping his fingernails and make him look like an asshole, or do I just leave it alone? So at that time, I decided to leave it alone. But finally, there was one last thing that happened, and when he came to Miami in spring training of that year, I finally just said, I unloaded everything in a column. This is what I've had to deal with each row over all the years. And I put that in the column. I mean, it's he's not a beloved figure, and that's a lot of the reason, you know. And he doesn't like dealing with the media, doesn't want to do it. I think would like to get the couple of hits just to get the hell everybody out of here, you know. And it creates an image about him which he doesn't really need.
Now we have exceeded an hour. What is your time schedule? Or should we call it a day?
What more do you have to ask?
I was going to say, I just had a couple of final questions that I wanted to ask you. You had observed in San Diego the World Series in 84 and the World Series in 98. You know, the two highest points of San Diego baseball and basically all of Tony Gwynn's career. Can you reflect briefly on those two World Series and how they impacted the city, even though they both went in both cases went against opponents that were just basically unbeatable at that point.
Yeah, exactly. The two times the Padres got to the World Series, they faced, you know, teams that were like the best teams of their era, and in 98, one of the best teams in history. So yeah, it's just the luck of the draw for the Padres. 84 was a strange season, because after this bean brawl war I talked to you about, which happened in August, early August in Atlanta. They kind of limped into the division title, but they were up ahead of the Braves by like 10 games. The Braves faded. Joe Torre was the manager of the Braves at the time. He didn't last too much longer there. In September, I think it was September 15th of 84, they were playing an afternoon game at the stadium against the Giants, I think it was. At what was then called Jack Murphy Stadium, with a chance to clinch their first share of the division title. There were 15,000 people at the ballpark that day. They won. I think the Astros had to beat the Dodgers or vice versa that night. So we all congregated outside of Gossage's house. He had a party in waiting. And they clinched the division title with a game that wasn't they didn't play in, you know, it was on the road at night, and you know, they celebrated out there, and players came out, and we interviewed them, and you know, I waited to write my story that day until after that because we had plenty of time with the PM cycle. So, and then when they were going up, the Cubs had a really good team that year. That was, you know, Sandberg, and they had put Boa, and they had gotten Sutcliffe in the middle of the year, and he went like 10-1 or 12-1. Nobody expected the Padres to beat the Cubs. And so we went to Wrigley for the first two games of the series, and it was a strange year because the Cubs were supposed to have, it was the last of the best of five NLCS and ALCS that year. Next year we expanded to seven games. So the Cubs were supposed to have the three games at home that weekend, but baseball took it away from them because of no lights on Wrigley Field. And they didn't want those three games to be played during the afternoon. They wanted to put them on TV, at least a couple of them at night. So they skewed the whole schedule, they sent the Padres for afternoon games in midweek in Wrigley, and the Padres just got their butts kicked. First game was like 12 or 13 to 1. Second game was like 4 to 2, but it seemed like it was 12 or 13 to 1. The Padres' starting pitching was the Achilles heel of that team that year. You know, they were great. You know, Alan Wiggins and Tony Gwynn batted 1-2 in the lineup. They were on base over like 400 times. Garvey had played his consecutive game streak came to an end the year before when he slid into home plate and dislocated his thumb. And his thumb really was not the same. He didn't have any power. He hit like 7 homers and had 70 RBIs, batting behind those guys who were on base all the time. Wiggins set the club record and stole like 70 bases. It's still the club record. Tony, I think he batted 356 and won his first batting title. And I think he stole 40 or 50 bases on that tip. So, you know, they had plenty of offense. But they're starting pitching, and they had signed Gossage as a free agent. They picked up Nettles in a trade before the season to fill in third base, and he was on his last legs. But they had guys there who, in Garvey, Nettles, and Gossage, who had won with the Yankees and Dodgers. They had guys, you know, who were upcoming in Gwynn and McReynolds. They had Terry Kennedy behind the plate. They misplaced Alan Wiggins at second base. He had a horrible year there defensively to play Carmelo Martinez in left. And it's something that would never be done today because the two guys' defensive metrics were just awful. And Wiggins was one of the best left fielders I've ever seen. So, but still, they played through all this, and their starting pitching was just bad. So their two guys got roughed up in the first two games, and then they came back to San Diego, and there were something like 20,000 people waiting at the stadium for them when their buses came from there. Everybody parked at the stadium. They took a bus to the airport. That's what the team used to do at the time. So the bus picked them up at the airport coming back from Chicago, and you know, I wasn't with them because I was in Chicago finishing up my stories. And, you know, then the story I got was that, you know, they were listless getting on the bus. And then all of a sudden there was 20,000 fans at the ballpark waiting for them. And it just revived them. And it started like the best 5 days of baseball in San Diego history. You know, they came back and swept the Cubs. You know, the first game, Ed Whitson was set, I think, 7-1. Gary Templeton just did a panel with him and Jack Morris about the 1984 season out at FanFest at the All-Star Game. And Templeton came out in the field during introductions waving a white towel. The fans were going nuts. I think the stadium at that time set about 50,000. It was packed. People were. It's like anything where the first time from the 15,000 to, you know, the opening first game of the home game of the playoffs, the transition in the community was just remarkable because you didn't know whether people were even going to care. And they just jumped. It's a bandwagon town, and they just jumped on the bandwagon collectively with both feet. And then game two, which was game four, that was the great Garvey game where he went 5 for 5, knocked in 5 runs, and hit the game-winning homer off Lee Smith in the bottom of the ninth. And then game five, the Cubs had the lead. Sutcliffe melted on the mound. You know, the ball went through Leon Durham's legs. Gwynn's hopper went over Sandberg's shoulder, and they won the pennant. And it really was one of the most raucous celebrations I've ever seen post-game. They went out on the field. The players went out into the parking lot and high-fived fans in the parking lot. It was really, really incredible. I mean, I've never covered anything like it to this day. And then they went into the World Series. Jack Morris shut him down in the first game. Morris pitched 2 complete games in that World Series, game one and game four, and they couldn't touch Morris. And then they faced, I think it was Petrie in game two, and they tied the series. Kurt Bavacqua hit a home run. A pinch hit home run late in the game, and they went back to Detroit 1-1 with every chance of, you know, doing something in that World Series.
That was the only game they won.
That's the only World Series game they ever won. So, yeah, and then their pitching just caught up with them in Detroit. You know, it was just horrible. And the Tigers manhandled them the rest of the series. And then we had that awful scene in Detroit getting out of there where, you know, people came in from all over the city. They were rioting, lighting up cabs. I mean, I was traveling back to San Diego with the team. It was those days when you did this. And then we were on buses outside the ballpark, and they told us to all get on one bus, and nobody wanted to get off the back bus. And the people were shaking the bus. Cab, I'll never forget this, we went by a cab, it was on fire right next to us. Finally, a cordon of mounted police came, surrounded the buses, and got us out of Tiger Stadium area to the freeway. And, you know, once you got two blocks away from the stadium, it was fine. But really, it's the only time, covering a baseball game where I really felt, you know, feared for my life. There was an AP photographer who was just retiring, I think, this year, Landy Ignelsi, and he goes, "I was in Beirut, and I've never seen anything like this." That's how bad it was. So that's the way the 1984 season ended. And then 98, you know, I was already gone to Bloomberg. I left in May of 98. And then I came back to cover the entire playoffs, Padres in the playoffs, through Houston and Atlanta. And it was a completely different texture. I mean, the city was just as hopped up about it. It was a whole generation of people who didn't see what happened in 1984, especially kids. You know, if you were like 8 years old in 1984, you know, you were like 22 years old in 1998. So you barely remembered, you know, what happened. So I think the city got a pretty fresh view of it. It was also the year where, you know, the John Moores had built that team. They had Proposition A on the ballot to sanction the building of Petco Park. It was an advisory vote, but there had been so much controversy over the expansion of Jack Murphy Stadium, and now Qualcomm, to accommodate the Chargers in the Super Bowl, that, you know, they wanted a citizen's vote on it. And so they built the team accordingly to try and win that year. And consequently, they had their best season on the field ever. I think they won 98 games. And, they defeated. There were some great games. I mean, they beat Randy Johnson, I think, twice. And Randy Johnson went to the Astros from the Mariners that year. And it was like something like 11-1 with a 1 ERA. And they beat him twice in the postseason in that series. It was incredible. Game one, Kevin Brown against Randy Johnson, and they matched zeros. And I think the Padres might have won 2-1 or something. And Trevor, you know, saved the game. And Trevor didn't have the greatest, it was a small sample size, but he didn't have the greatest postseason record in history. But when the Yankees came in, or they went to Yankee Stadium, you know, I wrote about this. About a month ago when the Yankees played out in San Diego. It had only been like the second time I think the Yankees were out there since the 98 World Series. And, you know, you just revisited game one at Yankee Stadium, and that pitch that Mark Langston threw to Tino, which looked like strike three, would have gotten him out of the seventh inning. And situation was Tino then hits a grand slam, and it just changed the whole World Series. And really, the Padres, they had a chance in game three, and Trevor blew the save, I think, in the seventh inning to Brocious. Brocious hit a home run, and really the Yankees just rolled over. It was too good a Yankee team for them.
Last question, give me some, you know, you said before about how the path that you took wasn't linear, and that to some degree you took certain crossroads and it worked out for you. Give me some brief reflections on your career as we conclude our interview.
You know, I've had a great career. I met my second wife in between game. There was a weird, they played on a Thursday night, game three of the championship series in 84, and then didn't pull, and then they had a weird off night on Friday night, and they didn't play again until Saturday and Sunday. I met what turned out to be my second wife at a disco in San Diego on that off day. She knew nothing about baseball, really barely knew that the Padres were even playing. She had like two little babies at the time, like a three-year-old girl and a boy who was an infant, and she'd just been divorced. We eventually got married. I inherited their kids, raised them as my own, and I've always said that's the best thing I've ever done in my life. Raising the kids, there's nothing more important in your life than raising kids. You know, what I do is, you know, I entertain people, I inform people, but I'm not getting a cure for AIDS here or cancer. I'm not that consequential. I don't have any sort of like view of you know what I do as being that significant. You know, people know who I am to a certain degree. I'm a kind of low level fame, which is just fine. When I got cancer and survived it twice, colon cancer, I write a lot about people who survive and get through things, mostly whether they're in sports or people who watch sports, and I just try to be a conduit to those stories to tell people that, you know, there is life after these things, and you can survive, and you can be better, and you can do things, and you can get through it, just like me, just like these people I'm writing about. Those things are very important to me. You know, otherwise, I mean, I've covered, you know, the Rangers. I was a Ranger fan growing up in New York. Covered the Ranger fan, Rangers winning the Stanley Cup in Game 7 at the Garden in 94. I was there when in Cincinnati when Pete Rose passed Ty Cobb.
It was also
against the Padres, right? I was there in Baltimore when Cal tied and passed Lou Gehrig for the most consecutive games ever. I was there for Barry's 700th homer, 714, 715, you know, 755, 756. I was there when Gibson hit the home run off of Dennis Eckersley. I was there when Garvey hit the home run off of Lee Smith. I saw A-Rod get his 3,000th hit. I saw Tricky Henderson get his 3,000th hit. In one of my early days, I wrote a story for Sport Magazine, and I was there for Gaylord Perry's 299th win and 300th win. Like I said, I get to these things. I'm just really fortunate, you know, that I've covered, you know, a lot of landmark games and a lot of these records. Oral Hershiser, that was another one. I was covering the Padres when, you know, he broke Don Drysdale's record for most consecutive scoreless innings. You know, it just sort of kind of goes. I was at covered the game at Candlestick Park when Dwight Clark made the catch to beat the Cowboys and take the 49ers onto their first Super Bowl win. You know, I was at the Garden when Willis Reed got hurt in Game 6 of the 1970 playoffs, and Dave DeBuscher and Dave Stallworth had to play center against Wilt, and they came from behind to win that game. It was the best basketball game I've ever seen. I covered the game at the Spectrum, sixth game when Kareem was hurt and couldn't even make the trip, and Magic played center and scored like 42 points and had a whole bunch of rebounds with the MVP. I gave great relationship, friendship with Magic, and all the other baseball players we've talked about. You know, there was a day back in the 70s when you went to do magazine stories on people and they took you to their home, you know, and you got to meet their families. You went out to lunch with them. You don't do that much anymore. So, you know, I just feel like I've been blessed and I've had, you know, great, varying and, you know, wonderful career. And on top of it, I've really had four jobs, if you count the Millbrae Sun and Leader. and otherwise San Diego Union Tribune, Bloomberg, MLB.com, and in a business which is fraught with danger and tightening belts and layoffs, you know, I've been fortunate enough at 64 years old to never be out of work a day in my life. So, sum it all up, it's been pretty good. Yeah. Pretty good life.
Barry Bloom, thank you so much for taking time for Sabre's Oral History Committee and giving us your reflections here in Miami.
Thanks for having me and doing it.